podcasts of the WDWNT Network are made possible each and every week by listeners like you and the following fantastic sponsors. Magical Travel is an authorized Disney vacation planner and is always ready to assist you in making your next trip to the Walt Disney World Resort, Disneyland Resort, or aboard the Disney Cruise Line even more magical. If you book a trip to the Walt Disney World Resort between September 29th and December 17th, 2009, you can get a free quick service meal, table service meal, and snack for everyone in your party for every day of your vacation. For more information on this special offer and many, many more, visit MagicalTravel.com and book your next Disney trip today. Resales DVC is your home for Disney Vacation Club resales. Whether you're buying or selling your part in the Disney Vacation Club, Resales DVC is prepared to walk you step-by-step through the process and make sure your experience is as pleasant as possible. For pricing, availability, and more information, be sure to contact Grandma Jackie and Kin at www.resalesdvc.com or by phone at 866-544-2919 to make your vacation dreams come true.
I'm not sponging for rum. It be gold I'm after.
Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-hey.
There's no turning back now.
Like a grand and miraculous spaceship, our planet has sailed through the universe of time.
Put up 2, 5, and 7.
You're just young!
Look at the guy in the goofy mask.
That's not a mask.
Sorry, lady.
I'm sure to do better next time. It was my first flight, and I'm still getting used to my programming.
You made it. I knew you would.
Hi, hello, and welcome.
Welcome to our show.
Welcome to the WDW News Today podcast, a variety show celebrating the Walt Disney World Resort and its fans. At this time, please welcome your party host, Tom Corliss.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the WDWNT podcast. This is episode number 107 for August 24th, 2009. Kick off this week's show, we have your Walt Disney World Weekend Update. In this week's update, we'll be discussing the future of the Tomorrowland stage at the Magic Kingdom, a new Fastpass option that is currently being tested only at Disney's Animal Kingdom theme park, and the new booking window guests will have beginning October 27th to make all dining, tour, and recreation reservations for Walt Disney World. Following the update, we have the return of our newest segment called the Golden Age. In this controversial segment featuring the universe of energy at Epcot, we'll continue our quest land by land, area by area, space by space throughout the world to find the golden age of the entire Walt Disney World Resort. So what are you waiting for? Let's celebrate another week of Walt Disney World information and fun on the WDW News Today podcast.
Yeah.
giving you a week's worth of news and rumors from the vacation kingdom of the world. It's now time for the Walt Disney World Resort Weekend Update with Tom Corliss and the Weekend Update News Team.
Your Walt Disney World Weekend Update. I'm Tom Corliss, and you're still not. Joining me for the Weekend Update, we have the Mayor, Justin Heyman.
How's it going?
Scott Smith.
Hi, everyone.
And Crystal Straps. That's gonna be in tremendous quality for the show.
Fantastic.
Great.
Fantastic.
All right, so let's get started, and we're going to start over at the Magic Kingdom with some news about Stitch's Supersonic Celebration, or at least the stage where that show used to perform. There are now tarps up on that stage, and some modifications have already been made. The border around the screen where Stitch would appear during the show that originally played there has already been modified, as you'll see on www.newsday.com, and if you're listening to the Enhanced Show, you're seeing that picture right now. But as well, there's big tarps around the left and right corners of the stage where the sound system and camera system are being worked on. And according to some rumors floating around, a show is planned to run on the stage beginning sometime in November. So hopefully some life coming back to the stage. It's nice to see them going and doing some work on the stage, even though there's nothing performing there. It shows that there's some life there and that we're going to see a show there sooner or later.
Now, looking at the timing of this rumored show, do we think it's a holiday show, or do we think it's just a replacement or a revamp of Supersonic Celebration?
I would think it would have to be something fairly large, because to put so much money into this space and then to take it to shut it down so quickly, it must be, I would think, more than just something that's going to run for a few months.
I think you're going to see a holiday show here in November, and I think around January, sometime early in 2010, I think you're going to see a new permanent show.
Do you think there could be something dealing with Toy Story coming in with the next movie coming out?
Maybe something Buzz Lightyear related? I don't know.
Yeah. That's
well, wouldn't they have that over at the studios, though? I mean, they've got a big Pixar presence in the studios.
Yeah, I think that's the general problem now, is that they're trying to keep the Pixar presence to the studios, trying not to expand anymore, even after all these years of Pixar attraction after Pixar attraction. I don't know. And the other problem there is that the whole reason they invested in Stitch's Supersonic Celebration instead of making it any other character was that it already existed. That technology, the interactive Stitch, already exists in Paris and Hong Kong. And, you know, it was very easy to just move over. Do I think they're going to go and reinvest in it and actually create a new interactive character? Probably not. So either Stitch is probably going to interact or come back on that screen in the next show, or, you know, maybe we'll just see the screen used in another way for the next show.
Yeah, I don't think we necessarily need another interactive show, particularly in Tomorrowland, since you already have Monsters, Inc., which is somewhat interactive.
I think it's very interactive.
And it's definitely much more elaborate.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just need some good, solid live entertainment on that stage. Because I think most of the problems, at least that I had with Stitch's Supersonic Celebration, were with the portions that had the interactive Stitch. It sort of really slowed down the tempo, and the show sort of fell to pieces during those segments. So, you know, I think just a normal, maybe character-based show here would work. Nonetheless, we will keep you posted on what is going on over there in Tomorrowland. A lot going on. Skyway demolition, Space Mountain refurbishment, and top of all that, the Tomorrowland Transit Authority is opening in just a few days. And, of course, stay tuned to WDW News Today. We'll be there when the TTA reopens, and we'll tell you what's going on there. Should be interesting to see what has been done. Moving over to Disney's Animal Kingdom theme park. That's right, there's news over there. Since July 20th, Walt Disney World has been testing the concept of a centralized Fastpass distribution area in the parks, and they've been testing it at Disney's Animal Kingdom. The test has now been running for a month and seems to be working quite well. All Animal Kingdom Fast Pass are being distributed at the It's Tough to Be a Bug distribution area on Discovery Island. The machines are clearly labeled for each attraction, and there are more than enough cast members working in the area to avoid any guest confusion. The Fastpass machines are not linked to the overall system, which allows you to get a Fastpass for multiple attractions at once. However, you cannot get multiple Fastpasses for the same attraction that you just got a Fastpass for. So, let's say you get a Fastpass for Expedition Everest, you can't stick your ticket right back in and get another one. However, you can go right next door to the Dinosaur Fastpass machine, put in your ticket, and get a Dinosaur Fastpass. So, really interesting how they're testing this. It's open. They're leaving these Fastpass machines open from the opening of the park in the morning until around 3 p.m. when they start getting prepared for the Mickey's Jam and Jungle Parade. But it's been a positive response thus far, and they're still testing it, which means, you know, it must be going well if they haven't stopped it yet.
Now, here's the one thing I'm slightly confused on. Do the machines in their little group, clearly we know they're not connected to the rest of the machines in the park, but do they obey the Fastpass rules for at least as this much? Let's say I have a 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock return window for Everest, and I go for a Fastpass for Dinosaur. Will that Dinosaur start at that Dinosaur Fastpass not allow me to return until 11? Or is there, like, it's just you get the next available Fastpass?
No, you get whatever the next, whatever is the available Fastpass for that attraction at that time, you're going to get, regardless how many you get. So if you go there at opening, and, you know, you could get it, believably, you can get a Fastpass for pretty much the same time for four different attractions.
So you could basically get instant go wherever you want in the park for any ticket, essentially, if you get there first thing in the morning.
Yeah, you could possibly get all your Fastpasses could be from, let's say, 10 to 11. For four attractions, you could have the very same Fastpass window.
I have mixed feelings on this, because on one hand, it's really convenient.
But
it's super convenient.
Is it very convenient, though, is the question.
It is, but
it is when you come into the park.
Convenient.
When you come into the park, it's convenient, but if you're standing in front of Expedition Everest and, you know, you want to get a fast pass for it, you've got to go all the way back to the middle of the park.
See,
to get that fast pass.
But it also eliminates kind of the trek for fast passes, which is kind of half the fun. Sometimes, you know, like, it helps you explore the park, planning out, you know, going down to get a fast pass for Everest and then exploring the rest of Asia while you're there. Or, you know, you might, you just want to ride Everest, but you don't want to wait on the line, so you just want to grab the fast pass, but you don't want to do anything else in Asia. Well, going down to Everest to get your fast pass is making you, you know, see the work that went on in Asia and how wonderfully themed it is.
Yeah, so, I just hope that, seeing if they like this concept and they decide to go with it, they do what they're doing here, and they actually keep the individual machines at the attractions running as well.
You know, I guess this brings up another point. I guess they've lowered then Fastpass capacity at the individual attraction machines because, you know, you can't really duplicate the amount of Fastpasses issued for something like Everest. It would really, really hurt those queues. So I'm assuming that they're still handing out the same number of fast passes.
Yeah, it's apparently connected to the individual attractions. So the Everest machines outside Expedition Everest and the two Everest machines at It's Tough to Be a Bug are connected. They're just apparently not connected to the overall system.
What's interesting to me about this is I see this heading in something that we've talked about, you know, kind of here and there on the show, which is the idea of possibly getting a fast pass at your resort. So I could almost see, because the machines don't follow the existing fast pass rules, and because really there's no reason that they couldn't be anywhere else. I mean, at that rate, you could put them at a resort. Maybe this is going to be an added resort guest benefit that you can get fast passes that essentially break the fast pass rules at your resort.
I would assume, though, that, I mean, this is just a testing period, that over time they're going to make sure the rules are all in effect. I mean, I wouldn't think that they keep these rule breakers in the middle of the park for the long haul.
I don't know if it's necessarily a rule breaker. It's a rule breaker to the already existing FastPass system, but if they revamp the system, introduce these centralized locations, and sort of break away the attractions from an overall system and have it more single attraction based. You know, I don't think that's breaking the rules. I think it's creating new rules.
Maybe if they did something like where they had one fast pass bank in the beginning of the park for new attractions, but the older ones still had theirs by the ride itself. I don't know.
I don't see why you can't have both. Yeah. I mean, I think there should be a centralized bank one so I can, once my fast pass for Dinosaur is up, but I want to get Safari next, I don't have to go all the way to Safari's and then track back over. Yeah. I think it makes sense for that sense. But if I'm near the ride, I can still get it next to the ride too.
Absolutely.
I don't see why not have both.
Yeah. And I mean, this is not the first time they've tried that, the idea of the disconnected fast passes, not connected to the overall system. They've done it at Maelstrom and Living with the Land at Epcot before. At Disneyland, they do it with Roger Rabbit's Cartoon Spin. So not the first time they've done this either. So maybe it's a sign that they've tested it before and they've realized maybe, you know, maybe it doesn't really matter if they get a fast pass for two different attractions, as long as we're not doubling the fast pass capacity for a single attraction. You know, it doesn't really matter then.
So you think that they intentionally did it, left it off the system as a test? Because I always thought they just were kind of lazy and just never hooked it up to the whole system.
Oh, I think it. I think it was all planned. I don't think that's a mistake.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying it was a mistake. I'm just saying that they didn't want to put the time and effort into making it all connect.
No, but that entire system was connected, so they had to unconnect it, and then those individual machines have to connect to the individual attractions. I don't think that's just because they were lazy. I have a feeling that that is because there's the idea that, you know, none of the attractions have to be connected to one another as far as Fastpass is concerned.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, it's all a matter of just reprogramming the machines to a different behavior. I mean, there's been machines that spit out bonus fast passes too. So there's, you know, clearly any machine can be programmed to any behavior pretty much that they want. Because the way I understand it, these are the old tough to be a bug machines, right, Tom?
Yeah, that's what they are. They are not new machines. They are. Well, of course, it's tough to be a bug never uses them anymore, so they're using those.
So they've just been, you know, been reprogrammed and basically say, don't make the guest wait. You know, don't make the guest wait for his next Fastpass.
And they recycle Fastpass machines as well. So the Toy Story Mania Fastpass machines are actually the ones that used to run at the Haunted Mansion at the Magic Kingdom. So they can take those machines and do whatever they please with them, pretty much.
So in essence, could they replace all ride-specific Fastpass banks with centralized ones, maybe even upgrading them with touchscreens so you can even pick which ride you want to use the centralized fast? Like, that would be the next evolution?
I think that would be a good idea, too, is having Fastpass banks, you know, all over the park in designated areas. Because then that eliminates the problem of having to go anywhere specific for Fastpass. You can just go to one of 4 or 5 locations throughout the park. I think that's a natural evolution. Unfortunately, there's other rumors we've talked about in the past few months, such as the idea that eventually the number of fast passes you receive on your vacation will depend on your resort standing. So those guests that stay at Deluxe will get the most fast passes. Those that stay at Value will get the least. And, you know, those who stay off property might even get none. So there's a lot of ideas for Fastpass being thrown around, and it's funny that we've been hearing those other rumors for a while, yet here they are testing a really radically different system. The idea of a centralized distribution area rather than something they've been doing for 10 years now at the individual attractions. So be sure to stay tuned to WDW News Today as we get more information on this testing, this Fastpass testing at Animal Kingdom. We'll let you know as it continues to run what exactly is going on there. And now, moving to our final piece of news, Beyond the Parks. After changing the booking window, a policy for all dining, recreation, and tours of just 90 days in late 2008, preparing for the advent of the online reservation system that is now operating, the Walt Disney World Resort will be returning to a 180-day booking window effective October 27, 2009. The changes were made official on the Disney Parks Twitter account earlier this week, but probably comes to no surprise to those who have been hearing these rumors since last year when it went back to 90. So, Here we are back at 180 days, 6 months out. You can make your dining, recreation, and tours, all your ADRs and such can be made now.
Yay.
I know Justin, much rejoicing. Wait, Justin's going to say boo, I'm sure.
Boo!
There we go. Tell him why, Justin.
All right, well, here's the thing. And I shouldn't say boo necessarily like that. It's not entirely fair. What annoys me is that we keep bouncing back and forth with this whole policy. Interesting fact, and Tom and I were talking about this policy yesterday, and I took a look at the 2009, what do they call it, how-to guide. It's the little brochure that you get when you make your Magic Your Way package reservation. Never did they change it from February till now with the 90-day booking window. They have always left the print at 180 days. Now, that might be because they ordered a bazillion of them and had to get rid of them, but I just kind of found it interesting. My problem is that if you book within 180 days, oftentimes it becomes very difficult to find a reservation, especially, I think, within the 120-day mark or closer. Now, for a lot of us, we have trips planned well in advance, but not always do I have one. And, you know, sometimes we do a last minute or something within 180, you know, within 180 days, and it's very difficult. And I also, you know, talk to the more quote-unquote average guests, and they just, they hate this. They hate this whole concept. Why do I have to plan my dining so far in advance? And while I don't necessarily agree with that, I understand why they're saying it. So I don't know. I thought the 90-day thing was difficult as well, but I think maybe there's a happy medium between 180 and 90.
Are you suggesting 120 days?
I may be suggesting 120 days, Mr. Corliss.
I don't know.
135 would be the medium.
140. 140. 115. I want to change my answer.
Sure. So
$1.
I think my problem with the 90-day booking window was we sort of went back to that era of, you know, 90 days out, you have to know the date, and that's the day you have to call very early in the morning if you want to get into certain restaurants. During the time of the 180-day booking window, I never had that problem, at least from personal experience. And even when going during the holiday season, Christmas week, New Year's Eve, and New Year's Day week, you know, never had a problem getting into Le Cellier, the Royal Table, Chef Mickey's, or any of those restaurants. So I like the 180 days. I think because it gives the opportunity to those that, you know a little more than 90 days. I'm not saying you should know 6 months in advance when your next vacation is. But if you know more than 90 days ahead of time, it's usually pretty easy for you to get the reservations you're looking for. I think 90 days out, most guests know that they're going to Walt Disney World. So giving people that extra time allows all the people that know well in advance that they're going the opportunity to book. And unfortunately, those that decide a little later will be a little late in the game. But that's the way it is in life. It's first come, first serve.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, Tom, is that, you know, we all can sit here and complain and moan one way or another, but the bottom line is, if you didn't pick up the phone first or you didn't get online first now, you may miss it anyway. So, you know, it is what it is.
And you know, it'll eliminate the complaints that Disney probably gets that people were on the phone at 8 a.m. 90 days before their vacation and they didn't get the Royal Table. Because once that booking window has opened and then you're then trying to book these restaurants, you really don't have an excuse.
Yes, yeah, no, I agree. What the other change, and I'm assuming this is still the same though, when they went to the 90-day booking window was the length of stay booking that you did not need to call on your 90 day out from your first day to book your first day, and then your 90 days out from your second day to book your second day, which I thought it always was, but there seemed to have been this big deal made out of it when they went to the 90-day booking window. That also kind of wreaked havoc a bit with this 90-day booking window, because folks who were, say, staying for 10 days and booked on their first day for all 10 days, and then somebody who arrived 5 days into their stay for 5 days was basically out of luck by that point in time, because somebody has already jumped the gun and that person had no ability whatsoever to do that. So I think moving back out to the 180-day does help that problem as well.
Yeah, but basically you do get... it's 180 days from the first day of your trip, at least if you're a Disney Resort guest.
Right.
And I believe even under 90 days, I believe it was 90 days from the first day of your trip as well.
It was, and I thought it was always that. But like I said, for some reason, I know a lot of people were making a huge deal out of that length of stay booking, and I'm like, wait a minute, it's always been that way. So I don't know where that was coming from. I don't know if it was not well publicized, and then all of a sudden it was well publicized with the 90-day booking window. I don't know. But I think that problem goes away with the 180 window, on a positive note.
It'd be interesting if maybe someday what we'll see is like 90 to 180 days out, those that are staying on property get to go ahead and make those advance reservations. But then once you hit the 90 day out, it's fair game. Anyone can make these ADRs. But it could be kind of one of these perks for, hey, if you're going to stay on property, you're booking in advance, you can go ahead and also get your dining reservations done.
I wouldn't doubt that we would see that. I think that goes along the same lines that we're talking about with FastPass perhaps someday being a resort guest privilege as well. I think ADR booking as well might become a resort guest only privilege.
Yeah, I think that would definitely be plausible and very, very interesting to say the least. I know with the most recent quote unquote changes to the Magic Gateway packages, they're definitely trying to stress, continuing to stress as we've seen them for the past 2 years, the idea that you come to Walt Disney World Resort and we have everything you need, so you need to stay here. Don't leave the property and stay here, with some recreation enhancements and other things. So that would definitely be a very interesting thing.
Yeah, I think they're certainly looking for more ways just to kind of add perks, more reasons to stay on property. No reason, like you say, Justin, to go anywhere else.
Yeah, and for years, those perks, that they used to advertise to you was the transportation and extra magic hours. Now, extra magic hours, for the most part, the only guests in there are indeed Disney Resort guests. But the transportation has been open to all guests forever. So, I think they do need to do more for the Disney Resort guests. Why not do something for the guests that are spending a little bit more?
This is a tough thing to balance. Get the right amount of days between people who know well in advance and the people that don't.
Well, but I think Disney wants more people to book further in advance. I'm sure they don't mind people making last-minute decisions to come there, but I think they'd rather know what their booking numbers are 6 months out rather than 90 days out.
Yeah.
And maybe they're trying to figure out ways that, okay, maybe we can incent and motivate people to start making this big Walt Disney World trip further in advance. Because, right now they're hurting because, they're discounting like 80%. Everyone who's staying right now, 80% of them, 90% of them are discounted.
Yep.
And they don't want to have to be doing that.
All right, that is going to do it for this week's Walt Disney World Weekend Update. Good night and have a pleasant tomorrow.
ancient Rome or Greece? Athens or Sparta? Birthday land or Starland? Let us find out when was the golden age of the Walt Disney World Resort.
Welcome to the Golden Age, where we're going to try and mathematically somehow figure out the golden age of the entire Walt Disney World Resort. Tonight we continue our journey land by land, space by space, and area by area with what you voted for in the WDWNT Network community forums, and that is the universe of energy at Epcot. So we're going to try and figure out the golden age of this Future World Pavilion on this segment. Joining me for the segment, the Mayor, Justin Heyman.
How's it going?
Scott Smith.
What's up, listeners?
And Crystal Straps.
Good evening.
Okay, so here's the way this is going to work. Just as we did last time, there'll be a few less of them this time around. We're going to break this down into specific eras in the history of this pavilion. Tonight, there's only going to be three, because there hasn't been a tremendous amount of changes over time, but there's been some big ones. So the three eras will be the 1983 era, or should I say 1982 era, which is the original Universe of Energy, sponsored by Exxon. We then have the 1996 era, which will be Ellen's Energy Adventure / Crisis, sponsored by Exxon. Completely new attraction, new storyline, a lot of changes. And then, actually, we're going to fast forward to the current year, the 2009 era, which has still Ellen's Energy Adventure, no sponsor, we just went through a major refurbishment, and we have a return to the original exterior color scheme, those oranges and yellows, that radiating energy on the building. So three eras, I think not going to be an easy choice for most of us, but let's start with Justin Heyman. Justin, what do you got? What do you think is the golden age of the universe of energy?
This actually is an easy choice for me. And it has to be the original 1982 universe of energy sponsored by Exxon. This was a very, very classic Epcot attraction, and no surprise to our listeners, I'm sure, me and classic Epcot are best friends. So, you know, it's you had the Radox screens, you had, you know, original music, everything about the original attraction, and you had the follow-up eventually in CommuniCore, which was really kind of that synergistic Epcot that we saw in the early 80s. So, you know, all of that kind of going together just really makes the original, you know, my golden age. Not to say that Ellen's Energy Adventure isn't a fantastic attraction. They did a really nice job with it. Just not top on my list.
Scott Smith, what era are you going to go with and why?
See, I have to agree with Justin on Retro Epcot Rocked. You know, it's my friend too. We hang out on the weekends, play some Turtles in Time. But I'm actually going to maybe be on the minority here, but I'm actually going to have to go with Ellen's Energy Adventure when it was the freshest, when it was still brand new. So that would be the middle age, because I just think it connects better, I think, to modern audiences, I should clarify. I think the story is fun. I think it's very tongue-in-cheek. I think it's got a lot of funny in jokes on stuff like the sitcom-y stuff, like dream sequences and what happens in these kind of sequences, and also stuff that happens in. I'm a sucker for rides that sort of poke fun at the rides themselves, and the way this one kind of did, where it talks to the audience and like, oh, you got to go into the next room, hurry up, everyone's got to move, and it's endearing to me. I like it. Plus, you found a way to make the subject entertaining. Plus, you found out a way to work in those really cool dinosaur audio animatronics, and you found out a way to work in Bill Nye the Science Guy, and I love Bill Nye the Science Guy. So anything that has him in it is automatic A's in my book. So I think that was the best one. Not to say the original wasn't good, of course. It was classic, but this, with a more modern story and a more accessible story, I think connects to people better and gets its message across more. Although I will agree, I don't know if it was a good idea making it Ellen's Energy Adventure and attaching it to Ellen DeGeneres. I know you got the name of the celebrity, you got a celebrity attachment back in the day, and then with Finding Nemo and her talk show, she had kind of a resurgence. I think it would have been better if they would have made up a character. I mean, yeah, then you wouldn't have had that hook, but then it would have been a little more timeless.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the story of this attraction is bad celebrity timing. And, you know, Ellen in 1996, just before this attraction opened, is when she came out on her show. So Disney, being the family wholesome company that they are at the time, you know, that was, you know, not what they were looking for. And obviously a lot has changed 13 years later. But at the time, they looked at it as a bad thing that they had Ellen in that attraction. And now here you are many years later, and actually it's really a very good thing in that she's, you know, she's a new idol for this era. She has a very popular talk show. She's been a voice in an extremely popular Disney Pixar film. So, yeah, very interesting how things change with that attraction.
It seemed like they didn't know what to do with it at first, but now it's progressive.
Yeah, she wasn't even invited to the opening, as unbelievable as that is. Bill Nye was there, and so was Alex Trebek. Chris Lestraps, what do you think is the golden age of the Universe of Energy?
Well, me and Retro Epcot, you know, we get along. You know, we're cool like that, but we're not Facebook friends. We don't follow each other on Twitter or anything.
Well,
but,
yeah, that bothers him, by the way. He doesn't like that.
So,
you mentioned it to me.
We're going to have to work that out. So, for me to pick, it's actually a difficult decision for me to pick, because the Radar pre-show, I think, is one of the top three Disney pre-shows of all time.
Yep.
Just the technology, just the use of it is incredibly awesome. And I miss that now in the current version, but I understand why the current version is presented the way it is.
By the way, if you don't know what the Radox screens are, and because we don't want to take the tremendous amount of time to once again explain them, because it was cutting edge for 1982, and quite frankly, if it was still there, it probably would be cutting edge. We actually did a Back to the Future on the Universe Energy, and we're going to refer you to that. And while Chris is going forward, I will figure out what episode that was.
So, yeah, well, like you said, I think it still would be considered cutting-edge technology just because you don't see it anywhere. So I think maybe it would be cool if Disney could incorporate it into another attraction somewhere down the road. I think that would be really cool. But I think I'm going to pick the second incarnation, the same that Scott picked, because I thought it was a nice, fresh approach to it. I like the story. I really like the attraction. It's extremely long attraction, and I guess the only other longer attraction Disney ever had was the original studio tour when the studios first opened.
Yep.
Which would give you hours of entertainment on end. But this is a very long attraction, but I think this does not seem like it's this 45 minute show when you sit down from start to finish.
Yeah, certainly not.
I think it flows really well, and I remember as a kid I loved this attraction just because I wanted to go see the dinosaurs. Well, to me, I think this attraction keeps the great part of the element of the dinosaurs, but it enhances it. And you have a very tremendous ensemble cast here, not just Ellen DeGeneres. You have Jamie Lee Curtis. You have Alex Trebek. You have Bill Nye, the science guy. You have a cameo by Michael Richards.
Who now they may be regretting that he's in the attraction.
Yeah. Right, yeah, that may be the more controversial of it all. Willard Scott. I mean, it's very cool.
Did you mention Chris,
Albert Einstein?
Did you mention Chris Berman?
Chris Berman,
Chris
that's
Berman,
right.
Yeah, he's in the radio portion.
And Albert Einstein, too, as Scott mentioned.
You get some wonderful parting gifts.
And I think it was very, very cutting edge at the time. I mean, we talk about energy so much this day and age. We didn't really do it that much when this first attraction opened in 1996. So you weren't talking about solar or wind or hydrothermal, but they were talking about then. So it's amazing how relevant the topics are now,
yeah.
13 years later, even though it's certainly that portion of the film could be updated and kind of enhanced from technology that's developed since then and information we know now, but it's still very relevant. And I think it's interesting that Disney certainly did luck out. Of course, the reason why they had Ellen to begin with was because she had her ABC show, so it's kind of the whole synergy thing. And I don't think you ever would have expected the longevity that she's had, but like you mentioned earlier, she's had this resurgence and come back. And I think that's Disney just totally lucked out on that whole aspect.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, I think when this attraction went down for this recent refurb, it would not have come back like it is now. And it, they would have had to done something totally new, but Ellen DeGeneres is still relevant. I would go with the third incarnation because it's the enhanced sound and the color scheme, just because I love the, that color scheme, but I think it's starting to be dated. So I think the relevance when it first came out is much more apparent. To me, the biggest drawback of this version, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, it's probably the worst audio animatronic I've ever seen. It's that Ellen, it's just awful and it drives me nuts every time I see it.
Well, I believe she is actually an audio animatronic from the World of Motion.
Right.
Just recycled, yeah.
Yeah.
She and is actually a pterodactyl that they put a wig on.
Sure.
See, that would be more believable, almost. So, yeah, I picked the second incarnation.
So you, what era are you picking? You're picking the...
The 1996 second.
Okay, so you've picked 1996. Yes. All right, things are about to get very interesting here, because I'm going to pick the 1982 era. And we'll try and figure this out in a few minutes, but nonetheless, as for right now, my reasoning. Number one, the original Universe of Energy sign, we sort of glanced over that big gray block rising out of that water in front of the pavilion with the red Universe Energy letters. Very cool. Not to say that the new signage isn't really cool either, because it is. That giant, almost looks like the 1939 World's Fair symbols, the, I forget what they were called, but the ball and the spike, whatever you would like to call them. Very cool still, but I think what makes the original my pick is the songs. I love One Little Spark. I love all these other great original Epcot songs, but for some reason, Feel the Flow and the Universe Energy theme song, those two songs, were my absolute favorite. They were really, really catchy. And, you know, one thing, you go back and listen to those today, and you probably say, wow, these people were really excited about energy. But I think that's what was great about early Epcot, and still to this day Epcot, is that they're, you know, they may be overly excited about their topics, but it's kind of cool that they're excited, and it gets you excited. The attraction, of course, as a young child, very impressionable, loved the dinosaur scene. Loved last year that the spitting dinosaurs were actually working again. Or this year, I should
say. I think they were working in July, yeah.
Yeah, it's the first time I got hit with them in probably 15 years. So that was surprising. Very cool. But all that stuff worked back in this old era, remember. So I just like that original a lot better. Probably because of the music, but I think the show was a little shorter, too. 45 minutes is a little too much. Ellen's Energy Adventure is a really well-put-together show. And it's something you don't see very often with these pavilion redos. Is that they actually put together a very coherent storyline that might actually be better than the original. And I definitely think that's the case, but I just like the flow of the original a lot better. So unfortunately now, we've ended up with a tie here, which ties the 1982 era with the 1996 era. So I think what we're going to have to do is simply add the two together, so 1982 and 1996... And we're going to divide it by two, and we're going to come out with 1989. And while that doesn't really decide what was the golden age of the Universe of Energy, it does help our mathematical equation that we're working on to figure out the golden age of the entire Walt Disney World Resort. So for argument's sake, that is going to go into the books, 1989. However, we need to somehow sit here and decide right now what was actually the golden age of this pavilion. So... What are the... Let's look at it this way. What are the pros and cons of the 1982 original attraction?
What pre-show.
The pre-show, as you said. I didn't want to touch on it again. But the Radock blocks in the pre-show, the spinning blocks, an amazing pre-show. So I think the original wins the pre-show war. Can we all agree on that?
Yes.
Okay. So let's just go scene by scene then, basically. So the on-ride film portions... So, in the original, you had more generic film, because it wasn't really a storyline. You had a more generic look at energy, and now Ellen's Energy Adventure is a really nice storyline. So, I think we give story, perhaps, to Ellen's Energy Adventure.
I can agree with that.
I agree.
All right, so we have the better pre-show in the original. We have the better story in the new version. Justin, I think we're going to have to concede here. Because as much as we love Retro Epcot, maybe, I'm thinking I might have to change my mind a little here and go with the newer version. Because, this, you know, we talk about on the show that story is everything. And if story is everything, I think Ellen's Energy Adventure does a fantastic job.
And I would agree with that. I can't argue with that. I guess what I can argue with is that the original attraction was really there to communicate, to teach. It was really a teaching ride. It was not even barely edutainment. It was educational, basically. If we look at that criteria, I mean, the only other thing I would add is the attraction audio, perhaps. Which I think the 82 version blows away the current one. But with those types of criteria, and that's often how we look at attractions here, I would have to agree.
All right, so then we're going to concede on this side that the 1996 era is indeed the golden age of the universe of energy. However, thanks to our mathematical equation, 1989 is somehow going to win this thing.
So not that's quite sure how that works.
It's going to work in the end. Because 1989 is going to be added together with 1999, which on the very first edition was considered the golden age of Tomorrowland. And again, as we go on through these segments, we're going to continue to add all these numbers together. And eventually, when this is all said and done and we've covered all of Walt Disney World, we are going to have a golden age somehow.
And the flux capacitor is going to blow up in our hands.
That's Back to the Future.
That wrong signal.
Yes, but nonetheless.
Congratulations.
Yes.
So, anyway, back on the ranch.
So we have hereby decided that the golden age of the universe of energy at Epcot is 1996. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it looks like that is going to do it for episode number 107 of the WDW News Today podcast. As always, I'd like to thank you for listening. You make this show possible and worth doing each and every week. As far as the controversy in this week's Golden Age segment, we will talk a lot about that segment and exactly how we're going to get to that final Golden Age answer in episode 110's Town Square Talk in 3 weeks' time. I promise any confusion about that segment there is right now will be cleared up by then, and Those of you wondering why there's two golden ages for the universe of energy, it will be clear in 3 weeks. At least we hope. Now time for the big finish, giving you all of the useful reminders you'll need to know in the coming week. First of all, to contact us here at the show with any questions, suggestions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at wdwnewstoday@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail message at 206-666-2982. If you have not done so already, please leave us a review on iTunes. It's a great way to let others know that there's an enjoyable Walt Disney World-based podcast out there for them. Be sure to visit the WDWNT Network community forums to vote for upcoming segments of this show and to view the show notes for this and previous episodes. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/WDWNT and to make me a friend on Facebook at facebook.com/WDWNT. And while over there on Facebook, be sure to join the WDWNT Network Facebook group, a great way to know about all upcoming events, including our fan meet at the D23 Expo out at the Disney Resort, and as well about WDWNT The Weekend, which is taking place August 19th through the 22nd, 2010, our first ever fan event at the Walt Disney World Resort. And more details on that than even on the Facebook group can be found at WDWNTTheWeekend.com. And that's also going to be the place where you can fill out the first event survey and as well sign up for the event newsletter that'll give you all the news first about that event. And we really do hope many of you can join us for what is going to be a spectacular event just a little less than a year away now. Coming up on next week's show, episode number 108, it is going to be a long one, and you probably guessed why it's going to be a long one, because we're going to go back to the future. Our Walt Disney World history segment returns with a I'm sure one that's going to be very special to many of our listeners. We're going to go back in time to Horizons. We're going to come to the present and explore Mission Space. And we're going to look into the future of that particular space in Epcot next week on Back to the Future. It's going to be about a 3-hour show. Just warning you ahead of time, it's going to be a doozy. Since I just previewed next week's epic show, that means that this week's show is over. And it's now once again time for me to deliver the corniest catchphrase in all of podcasting. That's going to do it for this week. See you all next week. See ya real soon.
Thanks for taking part in another episode of the WDW News Today podcast and celebrating news today. Please join us again next week. And remember to celebrate news today and every day throughout the WDWNT network by visiting WDWNT.com. This is Brian Summer saying goodnight and have a pleasant tomorrow.